This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is for Master Dogen's Shobha Genzo Koans. 127, Manjushri's 3-3, the main case. Manjushri asked Wuzhou, "Where are you from?" Wuzhou said, "From the south." Manjushri said, "How is Buddha Dharma being maintained in the south?" Wuzhou said, "Monastics in the declining age seldom follow the precepts." Manjushri said, "How large are the sanghas?" Wuzhou said, "Some are 300, others 500. And then Wuzhou asked, "How is the Buddha Dharma maintained here?" And Manjushri said, "Ordinary people and sages are living together. Dragons and snakes are intermingled." Wuzhou said, "How large are the assemblies?" And Manjushri said, "In front, 3x3. In back, 3x3. In the commentary, Wuzhou carried on a dialogue with an apparition, and in spite of it being with the Bodhisattva of wisdom, somehow it could still only see half. At that time, when Manjushri first asked, "How is the Buddha Dharma being maintained in the south?" Wuzhou should have showed him with his traveling staff. Then further complications would have been avoided. Manjushri, seeing past the dragon mask, compassionately tried to settle the uncertainty. Wielding the diamond sword of wisdom, in a single phrase, there's killing. In a single phrase, there's giving life. In one action, there's letting go. In one action, there's holding fast. Tell me, did Wuzhou understand? If so, then what is it that he understood? If not, do you understand? The capping verse. Holding up the adamantine sword, freely killing and giving life. Where positive and negative interfuse, every day is a good day. So I just recently returned from New Zealand, where we have a sangha and have had a sangha for 30 years. So we celebrated our 30th anniversary of practicing together with the students there. And so I've been thinking about sangha in preparing to go and thinking about 30 years. So it was 30 years ago this year that Dada Roshi went, and for the first time to the land of the long white cloud. And and began teaching and sort of creating the conditions by which a sangha could form and continue to this time. And really, he asked me to go that first trip. And so I went with him as an attendant and helped to try and pull that together. We did a couple of sessions and he did public talks, and there was a lot of, it was a lot packed into a short amount of time. And I remember thinking privately, this is never going to work. It's too far away. It's too remote. There's going to be too little contact. Of course, this is before the internet, and so just setting things up with phone calls and, you know, differences of time and day, were, it was complicated. And so I just thought, I just don't know how this is going to hold together. But it did. And through the efforts of a few, principally, but also because the Sangha there is so vibrant and strong. It's a very strong, connected, well-connected, very supportive group of practitioners around the country. Then we have groups in different parts of the country, and then twice a year, once when I go down in July, and then when Hogan and Hojin Sensei take turns going down in January, everybody comes together and we do a session. And on the basis of that, this community of practitioners has grown and continues. And so every year there are students who enter, there are people who do receive the precepts. Kaido is a senior student. She spent time here in, becoming a chief disciple some years ago and helps to lead things there. So it's they proved me wrong, happily. Happy to be proved wrong there. Sangha is a community of practitioners. It's means the virtue of harmony. The Buddha spoke of noble friends. And so it's one of the three treasures. It's something that we all practice within, those of us who are practitioners. Many of us, I think, come to practice comfortable in some way with silence. Otherwise, it's hard to be drawn to Zazen. Sometimes Sangha is more difficult. But it's an essential part of practice, and it always has been. And so this koan came to my mind as I was thinking about Sangha. This is a very well-known koan that exists in the Blue Cliff Record. Here, Dogen brought this koan back with the collection he came back from China with and included it in his koan collection, which Daido Roshi translated with Kaz Tanahashi years ago and gave to us so we can work with it. And so the story is that Wu Zhou, who was a Chinese master, was on the sacred mountain of Mount Wutai. And he was up near the top, and it was getting dark, and he was tired. And so Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, manifested a temple for him to stay in. And so he appeared, and Wu Zhou and he had this conversation that is the substance of this koan. Once their conversation was over, the next day, Manjushri asked his attendant to take Wu Zhou out to the front gate so he could be on his way. And while they were walking, Wu Zhou asked the attendant and said, "You know, before, when he said front 3x3, back 3x3, what was his meaning?" And the attendant said, "Oh, worthy." And Wu Zhou said, "Yes." And the attendant said, "How many is this?" And then Wu Zhou said, "What's the name of this temple?" And the attendant pointed to an image of a Buddha. And Wu Zhou looked. And then when he looked back to the attendant, both the attendant and the temple had vanished. So how is the Buddha Dharma being maintained in the South? Wu Zhou says, "Monastics in the declining age seldom follow the precepts." So it was predicted that the Buddha Dharma, the practice of Buddhism, would decline over the centuries after the Buddha's death. And so he's referring to this declining age. We're also within this understanding in this declining age, and some years after this took place, so we've even further declined. And he says, "Monastics in this declining age seldom follow the precepts." And so, you know, the inclination towards samsara is, in a sense, always present. We have kind of a natural tendency to move towards what's easy, to move towards what's convenient, particularly in our culture, to move towards what greets our desires and fulfills them. We have it within ourselves, that inclination towards complacency, shortcuts and so on, and it happens within communities. And I think that's the way I sort of understand that prediction of the declining age, that, I mean, first of all, everything that comes into existence will pass, because that's the nature of things. Nothing is permanent. And also, it takes a lot of energy, you know, once something has been brought into existence, to keep it not only existing, but vibrant, healthy. I mean, we just see that in our human lives, you know, that we can go through life and sort of do the functions of life, but not be very alive, not be very vibrant. And so that takes energy, right? We have to put in, like in a relationship. You can't just, you know, have a sustainable relationship. Who wants one of those, right? It has to be to actually make it vibrant and developing, maturing, evolving, it takes energy. And so we see that very clearly in our own practice, and within practice communities, the same is true. You know, in a certain sense, this is a lot of work. In case you hadn't noticed, it's a lot of work to do this, right? As somebody said this morning, it's, you know, in a smaller sangha, you see how individual efforts are manifest, you know, as consequence. And it's sort of easier to find a way in and to see how you can be of help because there are not many people. In a larger sangha as ours, such as here, you know, the same is true. I mean, even more needs to happen because it's a larger community, but there are more people to do it. And so sometimes people don't see all of the efforts that are going in every day, every minute, to be able to make this happen. The moment we stop doing that, it starts to, you know, come apart. And so, but that's a good thing. That's a good effort. It's a good way to use our energies, is to put energy into something that is important and vital and life-giving. And so here he's just commenting on how he's seeing the monastics seldom follow the precepts. In other words, live in accord with their vows. And then he says, how large are the communities? And he says, some are 300, some are 500. And Dada Roshi says, in spite of Wuzhou carrying on a dialogue with an apparition, even the Bodhisattva of wisdom, still he could only see half. So Wuzhou is basically just reporting the facts, what he sees, which is one of the two truths, the relative truth. Those things that are measurable, that are understandable, that you can report on, that can be seen. But what else is there? Buddhism teaches that there, perhaps more than any other religious tradition, has really examined perception. How do we perceive? Because on the basis of our perception, we have what we call the world. And on the basis of our perception, we have what we call ourselves and everything that self and world includes. And so, what is perception? How do we perceive? What's the basis of that? And very importantly, are our perceptions correct? Or do we perceive things as they actually are? Because if we don't, then there's little hope that we're going to find any life of harmony, right? If what we're seeing is not in accord with what actually is. And so Buddhism teaches that there are three modes of perception, where we can see things directly, things as they are. We can see things in terms of inference. You can see a smoke and infer that there's fire. You don't see the fire, but you can, with a reasonable, you know, with a degree of reasonability, to infer that there's fire. And then there's a perception, mode of perception, which is just wrong. We perceive something, but what we perceive is not accurate. And then within those modes of perception, there are three fields of perception. The first, again, being the field of perception in which we're seeing things as they are. And this is when we perceive things without any mental activity. So usually when we see things, there's a whole host of impressions and associations and expectations, past experiences, beliefs, ideas that feed into and become what we're actually seeing. So direct seeing is when that doesn't happen. And so when we're sitting in Zazen and practicing letting go and allowing the mind to find its natural tranquility, its natural resting place, that's so that we can perceive things directly without any interference. And then there's the realm of representation, where we're seeing something, but what we're really seeing is our mind's impression, our mind's desires for what we want to be seen. You know, it's like when you're going to look for a book on your bookshelf and you remember that the spine is blue. And so you keep looking for a blue spine book and you can't find it. And then eventually you find it and realize it's not a blue spine, right? And so even though we saw, we might have even seen the title, we didn't see it, right? Because we were looking for something else. And so the realm of representation. And then there's the field of perception, which is just called mirror images, which is when we're seeing things in our mind. We're imagining things, we're daydreaming, we're visualizing. And that seeing things as they are can be, when in terms of the motor perception, sometimes we see things accurately and sometimes we don't. And so we can have a direct experience. And so the classic example is that you see a snake and you react to it as a snake, and that's a direct perception, right? Because the mind hasn't interceded. But then you look more closely and you realize it's a rope. And so it's a direct perception, but it's not accurate. And inference can be the same way. You see smoke, you infer that it's fire, but then when you look on the other side of the hedge, it's not a fire, right? It's something else that's causing the smoke. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his book on the Yogacara school, which speaks a lot about this, says, we seldom have a true direct perception or a true inference. Our usual way of seeing things is false perception. A Southerner has ideas about Northerners. These ideas come from books that we've read or from what you've been told. And so suppose you meet someone who's been told, who you have been told is a Northerner. Because you already have an idea about what a Northerner is, that idea prevents you from seeing the actual person standing before you. Your idea is an obstacle that prevents you from understanding the person as they really are. You are not able to touch the real person of the Northerner, but only able to touch your own ideas about the Northerners. He says, we all have ideas about what a Northerner is like, what a Southerner is like, what someone from the Midlands is like. We have our categories. We put Northerner into one, Southerner into another, person from the Midlands into a third. We're all victims of this kind of perception. We have a set of containers in our deepest consciousness, and when we perceive something, we place it into one of those containers. But our way of placing things into containers is confused. And so this is how we perceive things, but perceive things incorrectly. And then on the basis of that, and of course we don't recognize that it's incorrect, and then on the basis of that, we act. And of course this is the basis of all suffering. It's the basis of all bias, prejudice, discriminating action, of oppression, is always seeing someone or a group and putting them into a container and giving them certain characteristics, right, that are given to all. And so we're not seeing the person, we're not seeing a human life, we're not seeing a being. We're not seeing a group, we're seeing our mind. And a mind that's based in desires, that has reasons for wanting to see someone a certain way that have to do with benefiting the self, fulfilling desires. And so when Wuzhou says, how is the Buddha Dharma maintained here? Manjushri says, ordinary people and sages are living together. Dragons and snakes intermingle. You know, koans use ordinary language, which is designed to convey information and knowledge. And it uses that language to help us to pass through the realm of knowledge. It uses language that is designed to convey meaning to help us break free of meaning. Because our minds are built to see differences, but it's society and consciousness that adds meaning to what we see. And that meaning conveys worthiness, unworthiness, high or low, entitled, unentitled. And on the basis of that meaning, then we build worlds. And so that's why it's so important in practice to develop faith in going beyond the meaning of things. Meaning can be very powerful when it's based in truth. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, very often it's not, or it's based in partial truths. And so in a sense, studying the Dharma is studying teachings that convey meaning that is based in things as they are, which ultimately are not about Buddhism. It's not about maintaining Buddhism, although maintaining Buddhism is good because it helps us to find a way to practice. But rather, it's about helping us to experience things directly as they are so we can live in harmony with things as they are. How is the Buddha Dharma being maintained here? Right? This is a question I ask a lot of myself. How are we maintaining the Buddha Dharma here? Is it based on the Dharma? Right? Is it based on what is convenient? Is it intimately connected with the wisdom tradition? Is it also responsive to the needs of today? How do we hold those in dynamic tension, in dynamic equilibrium? And how do we know with confidence that we're seeing things clearly? How do we know what we don't know? How do we know what we're not seeing? In the pointer in the Blue Cliff Record, it says, determining dragons and snakes, distinguishing jewels and stones, separating the profound and the naive, all to settle uncertainty. There's a time and place where we have to differentiate, discriminate, know the difference between a dragon and a snake. A dragon is an enlightened being. A snake is a deluded being. We need to know the difference between what's false and real, what's skillful and unskillful. If we don't know the difference, we're not going to be able to practice. Right? We won't know how to practice. We won't know how to help somebody else. But there's also a time to be free of differentiation, of discrimination, where all things return to the one, one field, one undivided, one true body, so that we can then live within a world of differences and discrimination and see clearly. The pointer says, right at this moment, seeing and hearing are not obscured. Sound and form are purely real. Fundamentally, it is so. And so then he asks, tell me, is this black or is it white? Is this crooked or is it straight? How do you know? And so we study. We look deeply. We try and hold ourselves accountable to reality, but really to ourselves. Hold ourselves accountable. Am I seeing what's real? What am I not seeing? How do I know? How can I know? This is one of the reasons that practicing together is so important. I mean, you can build a little hut in your backyard and sit every day, and on any day that you like, decide that you're enlightened. Right? Pick a day. Today's a good day. And there's no one to dispute it. Right? There's no one you have to interact with but yourself. I mean, I've talked to people. This may, you know, sound like a joke, but I mean, I remember talking to somebody years ago who was convinced that they were enlightened. And then seamlessly and without apparent contradiction in their mind, they talked about their life, which was a train wreck. And there seemed to be no conflict in their mind between these two realms. And so one of the reasons that training is so important is it helps us to actually see ourselves, to hold ourselves accountable in the best of ways, to see what is difficult to see. I mean, the fact is we're just so used to ourselves, right? We've been hearing our voice every day of our life, inside and outside. We've been encountering our thoughts, thinking our thoughts, dreaming our dreams, holding our beliefs every day throughout our whole lives. And so it's very difficult to see that as something that's happening, right? It's very difficult to see the way we're perceiving the world as our perception. We look out and it's just the world. It's not me doing something. It's not my mind laying a veil on what's in front of me. It's just what's in front of me. That's what makes practice so challenging, is how do you see within blindness? How do you open your eyes from within a dream? The miracle, I think, of human nature is that we're able to do that. If we weren't able to do that, no one would ever raise bodhicitta. No one would ever begin to wonder about samsara and begin to doubt. Ordinary people and sages living together, dragons and snakes intermingling. What is this living together? What kind of intermingling is he talking about? You know, I was thinking about, because I gave a talk in New Zealand about the Huainong, the sixth ancestor, and I can't go into the whole story, but he's one of the most celebrated figures in Buddhism, and there's a lot of which he's celebrated that has to do with his background. He supposedly came from the southern part of China, illiterate, unschooled, untrained in Buddhism, not even a Buddhist, a lay person, not a monastic, in a time when being a monastic was really, if you wanted to be a serious practitioner, you had to be ordained. And then he went to study with the fifth ancestor, Hong Ren, who was this very, very sort of illustrious teacher. But he had already gained insight into self-nature. He had had kind of a spontaneous enlightenment experience. And so when he encounters the fifth ancestor in this big monastery with lots of highly trained, highly educated monastics, because at that time, that's who lived in monasteries. Hong Ren said, you know, where are you from? And he said, I'm from the south. And he says, well, why are you here? And he says, I want to realize Buddha Dharma. And Hong Ren said, you're from the south. Barbarians can't realize Buddha nature. And so barbarian in the translation of the Chinese word, the footnote says, basically means something akin to an animal. And of course, we've seen how throughout history, when a human being is rendered into anything less than a human being, then everything terrible becomes possible. And so the interesting thing, and there's a whole function of that story within Buddhism, which is essentially, within the Zen tradition, which is essentially that literacy, being highly educated, being ordained, like all the usual stuff, isn't really what's important. What's important is your sincerity, your dedication, practicing. It's not about where you come from. But the part of the story that's never really brought out is how does this very highly developed teacher, Hong Ren, see this realized being who he eventually transmits to and makes the sixth ancestor as a barbarian? So he's still, if we just sort of take that story on the surface, he's still embedded within his cultural conditioning. So he's seen into the self nature of things. He knows, he's realized that that conditioning is empty. It has no self existence. It's not true. And that the functioning of that specific conditioning is to diminish, to destroy, to oppress. And yet there it is. So how is it that realization, that a person can have realization and not have seen into that kind of conditioning? And I think this is an extremely important thing for us as practitioners today. Ordinary people and sages live together. Dragons and snakes are intermingled. And what Manjushri is pointing to is at the deepest level, who are you? We come in as ordinary people and we want to become sages, right? Which means you have to, what are you going to do with your ordinary person part, right? We come in and we're deluded, we're suffering. And so we want to sort of cut that out, stow it somewhere, far, far away, right? And then dip in, you know, drink from the enlightened spring. We seek enlightenment, but we encounter our delusion. We want freedom, but we experience our constraint. We want to be the one who understands, but we meet our confusion. What do we do with that self? We study it. And we learn how to study. What does study mean? What does it mean to examine that which is so difficult to see? That which is so familiar that it's not even a thing. And so the teachings say, don't hate and don't cherish. As Master Dogen says, don't take it, don't give it undue weight. Don't think about it excessively, but don't take it lightly either. How do we practice the middle way? Deluded nature and enlightened nature, there's not one hair's distance between them. That's what the Buddha realized. That false perception is the distance between. Within that distance, everything comes apart. And so that's why practice is continually about dissolving, not the distance, because that's what the Buddha realized fundamentally doesn't exist, but our perception of distance. And the evidence is just, we don't need more tests and studies to know for sure, right? Just look in any aspect of suffering and see that there is distance between you and something. Then in the moment where love turns to hate, right? Where generosity turns to greed, where clarity turns to compassion, or clarity turns to confusion, it's because there's distance. And in that distance, all things become possible. All things deluded become possible. And so it's about realizing that the distance itself is the delusion. You know, when you're sitting and, like in Sesshin, you know, particularly in the beginning of practice and you're trying to practice your breath and really be the breath and experience that intimately, right, on the basis of faith. You know, somebody this morning in Open Sozan said, you know, spoke about being there for their, here for their first Sesshin and acknowledged that, you know, they don't really like Zazen. And I really appreciated that, right? Because it was a very honest acknowledgement of something that I bet she's not the only one. I'm just willing to bet. And yet, here she is, there we are, here we are. Right? When I first started sitting, I didn't like Zazen. Right? I wanted to like it, though. I didn't really understand it, but I wanted to understand it. I didn't experience in Zazen what teachers spoke about and the way they described Zazen. That wasn't my experience, but I wanted it to be. And on the basis of that, I engaged in something that in the moment I didn't like doing. But at a very deep level, I needed to do, I wanted to do. And that can, you know, from a distance, not make sense, right? In our world of, you know, get what's good. It seems illogical, and that's why it's a spiritual practice. That's why it's a religious practice, because it requires a faith in trusting something that you know to be true before you know it. And that we can do that. We can engage in something, and deeply, and recognize that there are ways in which we don't yet like it, or we may not even want to be doing it in the very moment that we're doing it. And that's an extraordinarily powerful function of human consciousness. That practice is really about, in a sense, harnessing the power of that. You can call it discipline. You can call it vow. Doesn't matter what you call it. Just use it. And so in the moment when you could very easily just pursue a daydream and feel the pleasure of that, and you know it's going to be pleasurable because you're already in it, right? And it is pleasurable. And that, or you could let go and come back to the breath, right? Right? It seems like a fairly straightforward choice. Right? And yet to choose to release that, that known pleasure, which the Buddha said is pleasure and dangerous. It's dangerous because it's not you. It doesn't belong to you. And it will disappoint you. All things are non-dual. And so the mind of anger, the mind of greed, of delusion, of pride, of jealousy, of despair, of hopelessness. This mind is not separate from compassion, from generosity, from patience, from faith, from humility, from loving kindness. It's one mind. And it shifts in an instant. And that's one of the things that we see in practice. In one moment, you can be intractably stuck in something. And then in the next moment, that ceases. And sometimes it's just the breeze blowing across your face or a word from the monitor. Or sometimes it shifts. And we should notice that moment. That moment is showing us truth about this world, about this nature. And it's showing us about dragons and snakes living together and intermingling. The truth of that. I was reading an article by a teacher in the Tibetan tradition, Lama Rod Owens, who's, as he describes himself, is a black, polyqueer, able-bodied, cisgender male Lama who is of mixed class and radically minded. And he talks, he describes himself that way so he can talk about what in racial justice work is called intersectionality. And he says this intersectionality speaks to the reality that we're influenced, all of us, by a number of identities, I might even say innumerable identities, all of which are informed further still by our social and political locations. So they begin oftentimes in how we appear in the world, male, female, light skin, dark skin, by our social and political locations, born in the South, born in the North, born uptown, born downtown. He says, we're not just white or black or gay or transgender. We are an expression of a community of identities and influences that may not be apparent to those around us or even to us. And I would underline, may not be. And make that an emphatic. Almost certainly are not apparent to those around us or even to us. Almost certainly are not being seen for what they are. And he goes on to say, in my experience, he's speaking as a teacher, authenticity as a Dharma teacher, and I would say as a person, as a Dharma practitioner, as a monastic, as a lay student, authenticity requires a certain kind of radical presence. And radical here speaks to a sense of remembering and returning to a simple and basic way of being in the world. Remember that mindfulness means to remember. It's like remembering something that you never were told, but somehow you know. Maybe that's why so many people talk about encountering the Dharma as a sense of coming home, returning home. So radical is a sense of remembering and returning to a simple and basic way of being in the world, one that reduces the violence to oneself and others, that reduces the aggression, that reduces the conflict, that reduces the suffering. It honors one's own passions and aspirations and relates to the world from a place of equanimity, a place that understands the high and the low, uptown, downtown, white and black, and sees it clearly, understands it directly. He says, when we choose this way of being in the world, we're at home in our own body, and we have no desire to leave it. And that, to me, is a kind of working definition of joyfulness. You know, joyfulness to me is not that you're always smiling, but it's that you have no desire to leave this body, this mind, this place, or this time. As difficult as it might be, that we are no longer seeking a solution that does violence, that is an aggressive act towards this body, this mind, this time, or this place. And he says that's so because now we are at home in this body. We are at home in this world. We now understand what home is. And at the heart of it is an awareness of this intersectionality. And so when we speak of identity, you know, in Buddhism, that just means we speak of that as the self. And the self is sort of a word that includes everything, every perception, every experience that is managed by the sense of you, by the sense of me. And that present within that sense of me and you, which has been engineered and designed, right, by our consciousness, but also by society, to disappear. Right, so that it functions fluidly. It functions without knowing. It functions as a habit. And so being a white person within a white supremacist culture, which means where white is valued over color, people of color, which I think is an inarguable truth about our culture, or being male within a patriarchal society, which means valuing maleness over femaleness, that those being those as part of my identity means that that is a deeply embedded way that I see myself. And that if I am to be free of that self, realize selflessness, then I have to understand the power of that. And that realization alone will not do that. And that's why I think that example of Hong Ren, this deeply enlightened being, who was still in that moment simultaneously recognizing this person before him as a lesser than, as an other, and at the same moment seeing their spiritual brilliance. And that's our capacity to bifurcate and divide. And so the only way I think that that realization becomes ultimately transformative and transformed within all of these intersections of these identities is that we have to actually work at it. You know, it would be nice, and everyone wants, this is what I wanted, I think, not because I wanted it, because I think everybody wants it, that if I just practice, do my zazen, get enlightened, then all of my troubles will go away, and all of the troubles that I rain down on you are going to go away. In other words, there are going to be no more troubles. I am going to see through everything. All of my habit patterns are going to be dissolved, extinguished. And I'm going to perfectly manifest as an enlightened being in my behavior. That's what Samantabhadra Bodhisattva is, an embodiment of perfect synchronization or harmonization. And in my experience and in my experience of others, that's not what happens. That we actually have to do that, which means we have to want to do that, which means we have to bring our attention to all of those different aspects, those intersections. And of course, the intersection is here, right?
This is where they're intersecting. And in doing that, be prepared that our life is never going to be the same. And that the way that's true is not the way we thought it was going to be true. We think it's going to be true in that everything is going to get so incredibly easy, right? And that in certain ways, things get harder because the responsibility, the implications of what we are seeing are so much greater. But the good news, there's lots of good news actually, but the good news is that as we are relieving ourselves of the burden of the self, of self-clinging, there's less defensiveness, less reactivity, less investment in that identity, in being that person, right, who doesn't have any racist, any patriarchy, right, any blindness, that never hurts you, that never says anything that offends you, right? There's less investment in the idea of being that person and more courage to be the person that I am. We are able to be at home. A simple and basic way of being in the world without violence and aggression, with no desire for escape. When Muzhou says, how large are the assemblies? Manjushri says, in front, 3x3, in back, 3x3. A footnote to this says, crazy words, insane talk. But by the way, how many is this? Even the great compassionate one with 1,000 hands can't count them all. Dada Roshi says it this way, where positive and negative interfuse, every day is a good day. That doesn't mean every day is a day without suffering. It means every day is a day when you're not trying to escape today. You're not trying to be somewhere else, someone else. It's like accepting, embracing the time that we have, that we've been given, and the circumstances that we've been given in which to create something good. A simple and basic way of being in the world. You know, to understand the karmic forces, to understand karma, you know, that which we create, that which we're influenced by, is to see the snake and the dragon in all of their manifestations. To meet the ordinary person, to meet the sage, to meet maleness and femaleness, to meet light and dark, and to not be afraid. And when you're afraid, to be afraid. Right? Being afraid doesn't kill you. Just be afraid. Right? Don't want to escape that. Don't desire to be somewhere else, because what you leave behind is home. You know, when I said that things get more difficult, they get more difficult in the best possible way. That when suffering, in a sense, increases because we're less guarded against it, that there is more suffering in the best possible way, in the way that is the path of joyfulness, that is the path of radiance and lightness of being. And you know, whether that makes sense or not is not that important. When you experience it, it does actually make sense. It does make sense. You know, since the beginning, the challenge has been living together and intermingling. It really all comes down to this. And what the Buddha realized is here. This is where I have to work that out. In order to work that out here, I have to do that with you. We have to do that together. And not just because it's expedient, but because that's the nature of this. That is dragons and snakes intermingling. And so our vow is to dedicate ourselves to that every day and to be willing to step forward into what we don't yet know, to seek that out, actually. And that's why Sangha is so important. Because when we do that together, that's good. That is a good effort.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.